settled into vast, neat encampments outside the city limits. So far, they'd behaved themselves extraordinarily well, too. Part of that was undoubtedly due to the fact that they hadn't yet had to do any real fighting, which meant they had no casualties to avenge upon the local citizenry. Another part of it was the eagle eye the chaplains were keeping on them, and their officers' stern injunctions about the importance of not providing the Group of Four's propaganda mills with the free gift of any atrocity fodder. And, of course, there were the bloodthirsty field regulations Emperor Caleb, Admiral Lock Island, and General Cherman had composed. Every man in the invasion army had heard those regulations read out in formation at least once per 5 day. And none of them doubted for a moment that Caleb and his commanders would enforce every stringent penalty upon any violators. The invasion's supplies, unlike its troops, were still coming ashore in a steady stream. Deros had many things to recommend it, including some fairly spectacular beaches, if anyone had had time to consider going for a dip, but no one would ever confuse its waterfront with Telesburg's. Wharf space was limited, its warehouses were far smaller and sparser, and aside from one or two main thoroughfares, the city's streets were much narrower and more constricted. All of that conspired to turn Deros into a logistical bottleneck. Caleb and his planners had realized that was going to happen, and they'd allowed for it in their original timetable. His engineers were busy building new wharves and extending existing ones, and some public buildings and houses were being demolished to widen roads and improve traffic conditions. The astonishment of the homeowners when Caleb insisted on actually paying them for their houses had been palpable, but that hadn't stopped them from accepting the compensation with alacrity, or from complaining loudly to their neighbors about how coin-pinching the payments had been. In the meantime, the invasion forces' horses and draft dragons required enough time to regain their land legs before moving into the field anyway, so Caleb and his advisors had always planned on spending at least the first couple of 5 days consolidating their hold on Deros while their animals recovered and their supplies came ashore. They hadn't quite made sufficient allowance for the limited warehouse space in the city itself, and more of their supplies than anyone liked were being stacked up under canvas instead of a solid roof, which wasn't exactly a pleasant thought with the storm season coming on. But at least they'd been able to send almost half their troopships back to Port Royal under escort by a third of the Chisomian galleys. That had relieved much of the port's congestion, and the shore patrol Cherman had organized and rigorously trained as military police had kept things moving smoothly and relatively peacefully as their forces ashore built up. On the other side of the coin, Garvai had already concentrated the majority of his 80,000-man force in the vicinity of Talbor Pass before coming farther east with his own advance guard. Another 25,000 men were on their way to join him, and should be arriving within the next 5 day or so. When they did, he would outnumber Caleb's entire invasion army by better than 2 to 1, and Hector had at least another 30,000 men within 100 miles or so of Garvai's main position. Those numbers didn't make for pleasant contemplation. "I don't like how carefully Garvai is thinking these things through," Caleb said more seriously, clasping his hands behind him and rocking gently up and down on the balls of his feet. "I'd be ever so much happier if someone like Windshare were in command over there." "It would be nice," Merlin agreed almost wistfully. In fact, he had an even better feel for Sir Corin Garvai's irritating competence than the Emperor did, since it was Merlin's snarks which had been keeping an eye on Hector's field commander for the past several months. He'd been focusing even more closely on that for the last few 5 days, Although his ability to monitor all of the sensors he had deployed here in Coruscant and elsewhere, even with Al's assistance, was being stretched to and beyond its limits. The fact that his hacked Pika's software had disabled his high-speed data interface was becoming an increasingly significant handicap. He couldn't really complain too much, given the fact that if Dr. Elias Proctor hadn't hacked the software, it would have automatically shut Merlin down and dumped his entire memory after 10 days of autonomous operation. But that didn't prevent it from causing significant problems. He had to review the data at little more than human speed, and even the fact that he could go so long without sleep couldn't put enough hours into even one of Safehold's lengthy days to examine all of the reports and recordings he ought to be examining. "You're sure he's going to come across that river and hit Clarake and Haman?" Caleb asked. "As sure as I can be before he actually does it. He's already started moving the bulk of his planned striking force across it after all." "Damn." Caleb said the word remarkably mildly, given his expression, and his eyes flashed. "Why the hell couldn't he have just sat on the defensive and concentrated on digging in?" "Because he is competent." "What I'd like to do is pull Clarake and Haman back," Caleb said. "I know they've spent months training for exactly this, but they've got barely 4,000 men between them, and odds of 3 or 4 to 1 don't strike me as the best ratio for their first serious battle."
"And how would you justify pulling them back?" Merlin asked.
Caleb turned his head to shoot him a sharp glance, and the man who'd once been Nemu Alban shrugged.
"It's one thing when you're there yourself, Caleb, when you can use your seaman's instinct to explain why you're playing a hunch with the fleet. But all of Cherman's reconnaissance reports continue to indicate that there are only a few thousand of Hector's troops on this side of the Dark Hills. You and I know those reports are wrong, or at least not complete, but we can't tell anyone that without their wondering just how it is that we do know. And Clarake and Haman are doing precisely what all of your plans and discussions called for them to do until we encounter Hector's troops in strength."
"I could still order them to stand fast until we get more troops up with them," Caleb argued.
"Yes, you could. But look at the terrain where they are right now. It's all second-growth forest, wire vine, brambles, and woodlots. Our people's main advantage is going to be the ranges at which they can engage, and that kind of ground cuts visibility to as little as 10 or 15 yards, even less than that in places."
Merlin considered mentioning an old Earth general named Grant and a place called the Wilderness, but decided against introducing the distraction.
"At that range, a smoothbore's just as effective as a rifle," he continued, "and a third of the musketeers on the other side have been equipped with flintlocks of their own. Those musketeers are going to be able to fire almost as rapidly as ours can, and given the absolute numbers on each side, those proportions mean Garvey's got as many flintlock muskets as we do, with twice that many matchlocks to support them. If we want to maximize our advantages, give our people the best chance for victory, then we need more open terrain, which, as it happens, is exactly what Garvey is looking for as well. Without knowing all our musketeers are actually riflemen, he's deliberately seeking a battlefield which will give him clear enough lines of fire for him to use his advantage in artillery most effectively."
"Which will just happen to do the same thing for our rifles," Caleb agreed. "I know that. It's just the numbers on each side, Merlin. If I could at least warn them, tell them what's coming, how many men Garvey has on the other side of the hill."
"Caleb," Merlin said quietly, his sapphire eyes soft with sympathy. "Once upon a time, back on old Earth, there was a statesman named Winston Churchill. He was the leader of a nation very much like yours in a lot of ways, actually. An island nation, which had relied upon its own navy and naval tradition to protect its freedom for hundreds of years. But when Churchill became Prime Minister, that nation, Great Britain, was fighting for its life against something that was just as evil as, and even more vicious than, the Church of God Awaiting is today here on Safehold. The Emperor had stopped rocking up and down. He stood very still now, listening intently as the voice of the Pika named Merlin gave life once more to a past so dusty no living man on Safehold had ever even heard of it. Great Britain was at least as alone as Caris ever was, but, like you, the British had certain advantages. One was that they were intercepting their enemy's communications. Those messages were being transmitted in a very advanced and complicated code, one which their enemies, the Nazis, believed was unbreakable. But the British had broken the code. As a result, they knew a great deal about what the Nazis were going to do before it ever happened. And one of the things they discovered was that one of their cities, the city of Coventry, was going to be heavily attacked by bombers. Bombers, Caleb repeated, tasting the peculiar word on his tongue. Machines that flew through the air at a couple of hundred miles an hour, loaded with bombs, like very big, very powerful versions of the shells Seamount is experimenting with. They were dropped from high up in the air, and they weren't very accurate at the time I'm talking about. The Nazis couldn't hope to hit specific targets or military installations, but they were going to send over hundreds of bombers. What they planned was a deliberate attack on a civilian target. It was called terror bombing, and all of the pre-war projections had indicated that an attack like the one they were planning would kill thousands and thousands of people, most of them civilians. It was very quiet in Baron Derwin's library. The bombers were going to be attacking at night, under cover of darkness, to prevent the defending aircraft from spotting them and shooting them down, short of their target. Navigating would be a problem, but they'd come up with a way to solve it for this particular attack. So there wasn't anything the British could do to stop it. It was going to happen. Under those circumstances, the question became whether or not the citizens of Coventry should be warned. Should Churchill order the evacuation of the city, or should he simply see to it that the city authorities knew at least a few hours before the attack that it was coming, so they could get their people, those civilians, including women and children, into the strongest, best-protected bomb shelters they had? What did he do? Caleb asked when Merlin paused. He didn't tell them at all, Merlin said softly. Caleb's eyes widened, and Merlin shook his head. He couldn't tell them. If he'd warned them, if he'd tried to evacuate the city or to bolster its defenses before the attack, people would have wondered how he'd known. Questions would have been asked, and there were some very bright people working for the Nazis, as well as for the British. Rather, as we're discovering, is the case with Garvey, working for Hector. If the Nazis had realized Churchill must have known in advance, they might have begun to wonder about the security of their codes. Were they as impossible to intercept and break as they'd thought they were? It was always possible, perhaps even probable, that they'd decide the British had figured it out some other way, through some sort of spy, perhaps. But they might not have. They might have wondered. And all they would have needed to do to nullify the intelligence advantage, which had become one of Britain's most vital weapons, would have been to change their cipher system just in case. Churchill decided he couldn't take that chance, and so he said nothing to Coventry, and the bombers flew over it, and they did enormous damage. Not as bad as the pre-war pundits had predicted, but terrible enough. And you're saying that if I warn Claric about what's coming, people may begin to wonder how I knew.
I'm saying that if you warn your field commanders too often, people will begin to wonder.
Merlin shook his head.
There's not a lot any of your enemies could do to prevent my snarks from spying on them, even if they knew all about them. In that respect, your situation is very different from Churchill's. But if the fact that I have visions which guide your decisions gets out, you know what the group of four is going to say. You can't afford to give them a pretext for charging you with trafficking with demons. It's entirely possible charges of that sort are going to be levied against you before this is all over anyway. But if they charge that I'm a demon, it will create all manner of problems. Not least because we can't possibly prove I'm not. For that matter, according to the doctrine of the Church of God Awaiting, I am one.
Caleb looked at him in silence for several seconds, then drew a deep breath. All right, he said. You're right. For that matter, I already knew everything you've just said. Not the part about Churchill or bombers, but the rest of it. It's just so hard, Merlin. I know men are going to be killed no matter what I do or how well I do it. However much I may not like that, I haven't had any choice but to accept it. But if I can keep any of them from being killed or maimed, I need to do it.
In the long term, that's exactly what you are doing, Caleb. It's just that you're going to have to be very careful, very selective, about when and how you do it. And what you can do with it in a strategic sense, when it comes to planning and projecting operations, or what you can do by feeding classified intelligence sources to someone like Narman and letting him make the recommendations I can't make openly, is one thing. Using that same information for something like this is something else entirely.
Caleb nodded unhappily. Then he looked back down at the table, eyes distant, while he obviously imagined the men represented by the tokens on the map. He stayed that way for several seconds, then straightened his shoulders and looked back up at Merlin.
What about this? He asked. Suppose I send a message forward to Claric, who's already worked with you and me both, and probably knows a lot more about your visions than he's ever let on. I won't tell him what Garvey and his commanders are discussing, or what they had for dinner. I'll just tell him I have a feeling our reconnaissance reports have been less than complete. That shouldn't be particularly surprising when we've got so little cavalry and everyone knows the horses we do have are still trying to regain their land legs. I won't pull him back, since there's no concrete evidence to support my feeling. Instead, I'll simply instruct him to be particularly alert in the next couple of days, and to operate on the assumption that the enemy may be much closer to him, and in considerably more strength than our scouts' reports so far have indicated.
Merlin considered it for a moment, then nodded.
I think that's unlikely to create any problems, he said, especially not if you don't include any specific numbers. In considerably more strength is a good cautionary phrase, which shouldn't suggest any definite knowledge we shouldn't have. And I don't suppose it will hurt a bit for the troops to decide that the seaman's instinct of yours translates into land battles as well.
I'd still prefer to pull them back, Caleb said, looking back at the map. Even if Claric and Haman take any warnings from me fully to heart, it won't change the numbers against them. And even if you see Garvey doing something else, throwing out a cavalry force to cut their line of retreat, for example, there won't be anything we can do about it. We probably couldn't get word to them quickly enough for it to do any good, even if we didn't have to worry about people's wondering how we'd guessed what was coming.
That's going to become something we have to live with more and more often, I'm afraid, Merlin said. And to be perfectly honest, the times when we can use my visions are only going to make the times when we can't use them hurt even more. But like everything else, there are limits to this as well,
We're simply going to have to accept them.
I know, Caleb smiled crookedly. I suppose it's just human nature to always want more. You're already the greatest unfair advantage any commander's ever had. I suppose it's churlish of me to want an even bigger unfair advantage, but there it is. I guess I'm just naturally greedy.
There was a saying back on old Earth, Merlin told him. I don't approve of it for many things in life, but I think it's applicable to military operations.
What sort of saying?
If you're not cheating, you aren't trying hard enough, Merlin said.
Caleb's mouth twitched, and the somberness in his eyes was lightened by a flicker of amusement, and Merlin shook his head.
Your father understood that the object in a war wasn't to see who could fight fairest. Mind you, he was one of the most honorable men I ever knew, but he recognized that a commander's greatest responsibility is to his own troops, to keep as many of them alive as possible, and to do his very best to ensure that those who die anyway die for a purpose, that their deaths aren't wasted, and that means not asking them to take stupid chances in the name of honor. It means figuring out the best way you can shoot their enemies in the back. It means taking every advantage you can find, buy, steal, or invent, and using it to keep your people alive. And, as another person from Churchill's War put it, make the other poor dumb son of a bitch die for his country.
That isn't a very chivalrous concept of war, Caleb observed.
I'm not a very chivalrous sort, in that respect at least, Merlin replied. And neither is any king or emperor worthy of his people's loyalty.
Then I suppose it's a good thing I'm a naturally sneaky sort of fellow. I mean, I'd hate to disappoint you or make you go looking for someone else who's sufficiently underhanded, devious, cunning, and unscrupulous to suit your nefarious purposes.
Oh, I wouldn't worry about that, Merlin said with a broad smile. Given your little explanation about what you have in store for Grand Duke Zebediah, I really don't think I could find anyone who was more underhanded, devious, cunning, and unscrupulous than you are.
Gosh, thanks, Caleb grinned, then gave himself a shake. And now that we've got that settled, let's get a signalman in here to get my I've got a bad feeling message off to Cleric.
9. Near Harrell's Crossing, Barony of Derwin, League of Coruscant. Brigadier Kint Cleric contemplated the dispatch in his hand, then looked down at the map spread out before him. Despite the Archangel Hastings' world-spanning atlas, the map in front of Cleric was far less detailed than he could have preferred. Mostly, that was simply a matter of the scale at which he was operating, but the fact that the Archangel's original maps were 800 years out of date, and that mere mortals had been responsible for updating them in the meantime, didn't help. In fact, it didn't help a bit. His own limited handful of cavalry, his scout sniper teams, and his attached engineering section had added a good bit of cartographic detail, but unfortunately, mostly it was detail about places they'd already been.
What do you make of it, Kint? Morris Heyman asked quietly.
Make of it? Cleric repeated, glancing up at his fellow brigadier.
Heyman looked at him for a moment, then smiled slightly.
"Don't give me that innocent look," he said. "You and I both know you spent the better part of a year working directly with His Majesty and Sajan Merlin. Did you really think I wouldn't figure out that His Majesty's little note says more to you than just the words he actually wrote down?"
"I don't have any idea what you're talking about."
Cleric's innocent tone wasn't very convincing. Then again, he hadn't intended for it to be.
Of course not. Now, to repeat my earlier question, what do you make of it?
I think, Cleric said, speaking slowly, his expression far more serious than it had been, that we're about to walk into a shitstorm.
That's funny. That's what I thought it might mean, too.
Yes, well, somehow I doubt the Emperor would have sent us a personal message like this one if he wasn't pretty sure his hunch was accurate.
You mean Sage and Merlin's hunch, don't you? Haman asked quietly.
The look Cleric gave him this time was far sharper, and the other brigadier snorted.
Forget I asked that. Haman shook his head. It's not really any of my business, I suppose. But just between the two of us, you might want to mention to the Emperor that I'm not the only one who's noticed how many new things started happening right about the time the Sajan turned up in Karis.
Oh?
I'm not complaining, Haman assured him. In fact, I think it was a damn good thing he did turn up. I just thought you might want to let His Majesty know.
Contrary to what you may believe, Maris, Cleric said mildly, I really don't spend all of my free time hobnobbing with the Emperor, or with Sajan Merlin, for that matter.
Of course not, Haman agreed politely.
Then he twitched his head at the dispatch still in Cleric's hand.
And in the meantime?
In the meantime, we figure out what we plan on doing if we should happen to run into any unfriendly souls.
That suits me right down to the ground. And, to be honest, I'd really like to find better ground than this.
Haman waved his hand at the tangled trees and dense underbrush which surrounded them.
I know this is good defensive terrain, but from a rifleman's perspective, it sucks.
Cleric chuckled sourly at the junior brigadier's succinct description, which he conceded summed up his own opinion quite handily. At the moment, they stood in a clearing which was little more than a wide spot in what passed for the royal highway between Deros and Monshir. To be fair, it was probably entirely adequate for the traffic which normally passed along it, but that traffic didn't include armies. Fatigue parties were busy widening the roadway by cutting back the encroaching tree cover and undergrowth and filling in the worst ravines and gullies, but they were far behind Cleric's and Haman's brigades. Fortunately, the two brigadiers had barely 4,000 men between them, so the less than marvelous state of the road was nowhere near as big a problem for them as it might have been for General Cherman's main body. Unfortunately, they had barely 4,000 men between them, so if they ran into sizable numbers of Coruscandians, they might just find themselves short on firepower.
And if we wind up having to retreat under fire, the fact that we only have one main road is not going to be a good thing, he reflected.
All right, he said finally. According to this, he tapped the map. There's a large village or a small town another few hours' march up the road. It looks like there's a good-sized monastery or priory of some sort southwest of the town, too.
I'd think that if people actually live out here, they must have cleared farmland, wouldn't you?
Probably.
Haman looked down at the map himself.
I wish we had better information on the contours, he continued, running his finger across the map sheet. It looks like the ground's probably higher on the far side of this river, he grimaced. I suppose that makes sense, since we're marching towards the mountains. If I were in command on the other side, and if I were looking for a defensive position, that would appeal to me.
Agreed. But if you were in command on the other side, and if you figured you had a sizable numerical advantage, would you be looking for a defensive position at all?
Assuming all I had were smooth bores against rifles, damn straight I would, Haman said.
But according to all of our intelligence estimates,
Cleric's eyes rose to meet Haman's for a moment, and he twitched the dispatch he still held very slightly.
This Garvai doesn't know anything about our rifles.
True.
Haman rubbed his chin.
If it should happen those estimates are actually accurate, then you're probably right. Garvai ought to be thinking about jumping on us and smashing us up.
Exactly. And in addition to that, I'm sure he'd prefer to keep us from getting a foothold on the far side of the river, especially if you're right. And I think you probably are, about the rising ground over there.
You think he'll come across the river? Fight with it in his rear?
I do. Clarake nodded sharply. We don't know enough about bridges, or whether there might be practical fords, to really be able to estimate how serious an obstacle it may be. And I'll almost guarantee you he has a lot better information on where we are, and in what strength, than we have about him. It's for damn sure he's got a lot more cavalry swanning around out there to tell him about us, at any rate, and I'm going to assume he's smart enough to know what to do with it.
Suits me, Haman agreed.
Well, in that case, he's probably got a pretty fair notion of how many men we've got. If I were him, I'd be thinking in terms of putting enough of my men on this side of the river to eat a force our size for breakfast. I don't think I'd put any more of my total manpower over here than I figured I'd need for the job, though. That way, if it turned out I was wrong and I had to retreat, I wouldn't be stacked 10 deep trying to get across the bridges, and I'd have the bulk of my troops available on the far side of the river to hold the high ground and cover the advanced force if it did have to retreat.
Makes sense, Haman said after considering it briefly.
Well, assuming this little exercise in mind-reading has any merit, I think it's also safe to assume he wouldn't want to give us the gift of any better defensible terrain than he has to when he attacks us. If I were him, and if I was feeling really clever, I'd figure on fighting somewhere in here.
Clarake's finger traced a rough oval around the town and the monastery.
He'll want open ground so he can close with us as quickly as possible, especially if he's thinking about plowing us into the ground with pikes or cavalry. And he'll want us as far forward out of these miserable woods as he can get us, so that when we break, we'll be jammed up against the trees trying to funnel down the road.
Haman nodded again, and Clarake smiled thinly.
The one good thing about this miserable patch of trees and briars is that if there's only one road through it, at least it's not easy to get lost.
Meaning?
Meaning we can continue marching after dark without losing entire companies down side roads. There aren't any side roads. The most there are is paths and foot trails no one is going to confuse with the main right-of-way.
We've got another 2 or 3 hours of daylight, too, Haman observed.
Yes, we do.
Clarake looked over his shoulder at a grizzled-looking man in the uniform of a sergeant major.
Mark?
Yes, sir?
Brigade Sergeant Major McKinty Dragonmaster replied.
Find me a runner, then figure out exactly where Colonel Johnston is so we know where to send him.
Joel Johnston was the commander of the 1/3 Battalion, 1st Battalion of the 3rd Brigade. He was also a cool and level-headed man, which qualities had made him Clarake's choice to lead the advance.
Aye, sir.
Dragonmaster's broad shoulders straightened as he came to an abbreviated position of attention. Then he turned away from the two brigadiers with a purposeful air.
I'm going to send Johnston on ahead, Clarake continued, turning back to Haman. If he pushes, he should be able to get to more open ground near the town before sunset. And, if we're reading Garvai's intentions the right way, he's going to be patient. He won't jump Johnston the instant the first clears the woods because he'll want more of us in his trap. He might have some pickets out to skirmish with us, convince us to stop for the night, or at least advance more slowly, but he might not even do that. More likely, he'll settle for posting a few scouts well in advance of his own positions just to warn him if we keep coming. Then he'll wait for us to stick our heads firmly into the noose before he yanks it tight.
Very devious of him, Haman said dryly.
I'd rather assume he's more devious than he is than make the mistake of assuming he's less devious than he turns out to be.
Oh, I'm not complaining, Haman assured him.
Good. What I want Johnston to do is to move as quickly as he can to the edge of the more open ground we think is up there. But then I want him to advance just a little way more and start settling in for the night. Once it's dark, though, he'll put his men back into motion and...
So they're taking it a little easy, are they?
Corin Garvai murmured to himself. The sun had set an hour and a half before, and insects buzzed and zinged around the lanterns illuminating his veranda command post. His thigh muscles ached just a bit from the time he, Windshare, and Doyle had spent in the saddle. But the personal reconnaissance had been worth it. He had the terrain around Harrell's Priory and the town of Harrell's Crossing firmly in his mind now. He'd found himself wondering exactly who the Harrell who'd strewn his name around this locale so generously had been. But that idle curiosity had taken fourth or fifth place on his things to wonder about list. Now he sat in a comfortable, cushioned wicker chair, gnawing on a fried chicken breast and trying not to get greasy fingerprints on his map while he worked his way through the latest dispatches from Windshare's mounted pickets.
Alex done himself proud, Garvai reflected. He may not be the very brightest star in the heavens, but Langhorne knows he works hard with the wit God gave him.
He reached the final message, read it as carefully as he had the first, then handed his plate to one of his staffers, and frowned thoughtfully.
I'd be happier if they moved further forward, he admitted to himself. If the cavalry reports are accurate, that's no more than a third, maybe even a quarter of their total strength. And given the crappy nature of the terrain they've been advancing through, we could be underestimating their strength significantly.
His frown deepened as he acknowledged that possibility. On the other hand, if the Carizians were present in greater numbers, then they were going to be even more jammed up than he'd hoped for on the section of highway through the tangled wilderness in front of his chosen battlefield.
Should I move further forward?
He closed his eyes, considering the ground he'd ridden over. It was tempting in many ways. In fact, if his objective had been simply to stop the Carizians, that was exactly what he would have done. But he didn't want to stop them. He wanted to smash them, and for that he needed them out in the open where he could get at them.
Besides, like I told Charles earlier, if I try moving units around in the dark, they're only going to get lost, or worse, someone's going to blunder into the enemy and tell them we're here. Of course, unless they're imbeciles, they must realize we're out here somewhere. That doesn't make it a good idea to confirm our positions for them, though.
He pondered his mental map for several more seconds, then opened his eyes once more and beckoned to his clerk.
Yes, sir?
Message for Earl Windshare.
Yes, sir.
The clerk readied his notepad, and Garvai tipped back in his chair.
My Lord Earl, he began, from your scout's latest reports, the enemy seems to be planning to hold his present position until morning, before resuming his advance. I anticipate that he will continue towards Harrell's Crossing tomorrow, with the intention of securing the bridge there. He may also intend to direct a smaller column on the Priory in order to secure the wooden bridge, assuming he knows or learns of its existence. In either case, I believe we may assume he will continue advancing along the highway at or shortly after dawn. From his present position, he will be required to advance approximately 6 miles before he encounters our forward positions. If our estimate of his total troop strength is accurate,
That advance should take long enough for his entire strength to clear the undergrowth behind him and emerge into the more open ground between the woods and the town. If that should prove to be the case, it is my intention to cut off and destroy his entire force. To that end, you are directed to prepare a force of cavalry adequate to advance into his rear and cut the highway behind him after he clears the woods. However, I do not desire for you to engage his infantry unless he attempts to force his way past you in order to escape my own forces. Given the importance of keeping him in ignorance of our own positions, intentions, and strength, I do not wish you to move until after daylight. You are to keep the highway under observation if at all possible, and to advance into his rear only after he has fully emerged from the woods, unless otherwise directed by myself. To this end, I wish for such force as you deem adequate to the purposes of this instruction to be prepared for movement 1 hour before dawn, but to remain in position until the conditions stipulated in the above paragraphs have been met. He paused, considering whether or not to add anything else, then shrugged mentally. "Read that back," he directed, and listened carefully as the clerk complied. Then he nodded. "Very good. Write up a fair copy for my signature. I want it delivered within the hour, if at all possible. And I want a receipt from the Earl's staff to confirm its delivery."
"We seen a few cavalry kind of drifting around out there, sir," the sergeant told Colonel Joel Johnston.
He spoke softly, as if he were afraid the enemy might overhear him, which made his Locare dialect even more difficult for Johnston's Telesburg-born ears. The precaution was probably unnecessary, too, but that wasn't something Johnston was going to criticize under the circumstances.
"Do you think they know you saw them?" he asked.
"Hard to say, sir, to be honest," the sergeant admitted. "We kept to cover much as we could, just like you said. And I didn't pick no city boys, begging your pardon. We weren't making much noise, and a man on a horse is easier to see nor a man on foot. But it could be they saw us. And if they were smart and put somebody out on foot in front of them, so's we'd see the mounted ones and not notice the others, I couldn't swear we'd have spotted 'em at it, and that's a fact, Colonel."
"Understood, Sergeant," Johnston nodded. However rustic the non-com might have sounded, there was nothing at all wrong with his brain, and Johnston made a mental note to commend him in his own report. The explosively expanding Carizian Marines desperately needed competent officers, and the sergeant might just make one of them. On the other hand, they needed experienced, capable, and smart sergeants just as badly, as any officer worth his salt was well aware. And the scout sniper units Brigadier Clarek had organized needed them worse than most.
"You did well, Sergeant Whiston," he said now. "Very well. Thank you."
"Yes, sir. Thank you, sir."
Johnston couldn't see Whiston very clearly in the darkness, but he could hear the sergeant's smile of pleasure at the well-deserved words of praise. The colonel did a little smiling of his own, then frowned as he considered Whiston's report. It fitted well with all of the other reports he'd so far received. The Coruscandians had cavalry pickets scattered across an arc that extended about 3,000 to 3,500 yards from where the highway cleared the woods, with the concave side towards Johnston's battalion. That gave him some room for maneuver, but not enough to carry out his orders. He pondered it for several more minutes, then shrugged. He could have sent a messenger back to the brigadier with a dispatch summarizing the situation and asking for fresh instructions. But the Marine tradition had always been that once a superior officer's intentions were understood, it was up to a junior officer to show a certain degree of initiative in accomplishing those intentions. He knew what Brigadier Clarek wanted to happen. It was just a matter of seeing to it that it did. "And there's a way," he mused,
his thoughtful frown turning into a cold, thin smile.
I'm afraid Sergeant Whiston isn't going to get much rest this evening.
What was that?
What was what?
The corporal in charge of the three-man cavalry picket demanded irritably.
I heard something,
the private who'd spoken up said.
Like what?
The corporal, the private noted, wasn't getting any less irritable.
I don't know what, the trooper said a bit defensively. A sound. A branch breaking, maybe.
The corporal rolled his eyes. Given the stiff breeze sighing through the tall wheat around them, the chance that the other man could actually have heard something was remote, to say the least. He started to rip a strip off the unfortunate private's backside, then stopped himself. The man might be an idiot, but better an idiot who reported an imaginary sound he thought he'd heard than the sort of idiot who wouldn't report something he really did hear for fear of being reamed out.
Look, he began as patiently as he could. It's dark, we're all tired, we know the bastards are out there.
He waved one arm in an arc to the south.
And we're all listening as hard as we can. But there's enough wind stirring this crap around to make a man think he's hearing just about anything. So,
the patient corporal never completed his final sentence. The hand which snaked around him from behind cupped his chin and yanked his head back for the knife in the other hand, saw to that. The picket leader's blood fountained from his slashed throat, spraying over the nearer of the other two troopers. That unfortunate soul jumped back, mouth opening to shout something, but his instinctive recoil from the dying corporal took him directly into the arms of a second Carizian Marine, and a second combat knife went home with a gurgle. The alert trooper who'd thought he'd heard something was a quick-witted fellow. He didn't waste time trying to get to his horse. He simply turned and bolted into the darkness. That took him directly away from the two Marines who'd been detailed to cover the horses. Unhappily for him, it took him directly into the path of Sergeant Edvard Whiston. Still, he made out better than his fellows, although he might be forgiven for not realizing that immediately as Whiston's rifle butt slammed into the pit of his belly. The cavalryman folded up with an agonized, wheezing gasp, and the sergeant struck him again, this time a scientific blow across the back of his neck that didn't quite pulverize any vertebrae.
Good work,
Whiston told the other members of his squad softly, as they filtered out of the darkness around him and the single unconscious survivor of the cavalry picket. Unlike the majority of the men of Brigadier Clarake's 3rd Brigade, Whiston and his men wore single-piece garments of mottled green and brown, rather than the traditional light blue breeches and dark blue tunics of the Royal Carizian Marines. Their rifles were also shorter than the standard weapon, with browned barrels, and the brims of their traditional broad-brimmed black hats were sharply rolled on the right side. Their distinctive garb marked them as scout snipers. None of them were aware that the inspiration for their organization had come from a chance remark Sajan Merlin had dropped in conversation with Brigadier Clarake when he'd been only a major. What they were aware of was that they'd been selected and trained specifically as a small elite force to be attached to standard Marine formations. They were intended for missions exactly like the one they'd just carried out, and their function, once combat was joined, was to serve as covering skirmishers in the early stages, and to specifically target any officer they could identify on the other side. Quite a few of them had enjoyed previous careers as hunters, or in some cases, poachers, and they'd developed a distinctive swagger which was guaranteed to irk any other Marine whose path they happened to cross in a tavern or bordello. Many of them, as a consequence, had come to know the shore patrol quite well. This was the first time they'd actually been used in the field, of course.
Sergeant Wistan was well aware that he, his men, and the entire scout-sniper concept were on trial. Although it might not have occurred to him to describe it in precisely those terms, he was determined that they were going to prove themselves, and so far he had nothing to chew anyone out for. So far.
Jacques, go back and tell the lieutenant where we are. Tell him the last picket on the list's gone. The rest of us'll wait here.
Aye, Sarge.
The indicated Marine nodded, then went loping off into the darkness.
The rest of you take position,
Wistan continued, and the others filtered out to form a loose perimeter around the former picket's position. Wistan watched them critically, then grunted in satisfaction and squatted to check on the surviving Coruscandian's condition. 10. Harrell's Crossing, Barony of Derwin, League of Coruscant. Sir Corin Garvey made himself look patient as he waited for the early dawn light to creep back into the world. He could smell rain, but it didn't feel very imminent, and its approach suggested that the day might at least be a little cooler than yesterday had been. That would be nice, although if things went as he'd planned, today would be hot enough to satisfy anyone. There, he thought, watching the first hint of salmon and gold creep across the eastern horizon. It won't be much longer now. He'd left his headquarters at the planter's house and ridden forward to keep a personal eye on things. But he hadn't gone beyond the town itself. Tempting though it was, he knew he had no business with his most forward formations. Nothing they might gain from his presence in terms of improved morale or steadiness would be worth the possibility that he might be taken out of action, or the much greater probability that he would find himself bogged down in some purely local situation when he ought to be supervising the overall battle. After considering carefully, he'd chosen the steeple of Harrell's Crossing's biggest church as his forward command post. It would give him the best view over the greatest area. It offered good height for the semaphore mast his engineers had rigged overnight, and it was a prominent enough landmark, especially now that it had the mast stuck on top of it, that couriers trying to locate him with messages from his subordinate commanders shouldn't find their task difficult. Now he yawned, cradling a cup of hot chocolate in both hands, while the sky gradually brightened and details began to emerge from the darkness. He was glad he'd made his decision to get the troops into position yesterday. Either Winshare's scouts had misreported the Carisian column's position earlier in the day, or else the Carisians had picked up the pace considerably yesterday afternoon. He was inclined to believe it was probably a combination of the two. Estimating the enemy's position accurately in such heavily overgrown terrain would have been difficult at the best of times, and he would have liked to ascribe the Carisians' unanticipatedly early arrival solely to a perfectly natural mistake on the cavalry's part. But he didn't think it was that simple, and he wondered if the Carisians might somehow have caught wind of his own presence at Harrell's Crossing. He didn't see how they could have gotten any of their own scouts close enough for that without even being detected, but it was always possible one of the locals had provided information to the other side, whether involuntarily or in return for payment. He sipped chocolate, savoring the rich flavor, and fresh energy seemed to trickle through his veins. It shouldn't be much longer now. There. Those were the standards of his farthest forward battalions. He still didn't have as many muskets, flintlock, or matchlock as he would have preferred. Worse, according to his own cavalry scouts' reports, every single one of the Carisians they'd seen so far appeared to be armed with a flintlock musket, whereas a third of his own men were still armed with pikes. Fortunately, he had a lot more men than the Carizians did, and while he might be weaker, proportionately, in firepower, the difference in total manpower meant he actually had more of them absolutely. And whatever the relative numbers of firearms might be, those pikes were going to be a nasty handful if the infantry formations ever managed to close. The light was still too poor for him to use his spyglass, but he squinted his eyes, peering eastward to where the shadows of the tangled woodland continued to conceal the single Carizian battalion which had encamped just this side of them. They ought to be about... Garvey's eyes widened in sudden astonishment. Surely it was only a trick of the light. He set his chocolate cup aside and stepped closer to the open side of the belfry. He was conscious of the cool breeze, the awakening twitter of birds and gentle whistling of wyverns, and the dew-slick, man-sized bell hanging just behind him, like some watching presence. And he was also conscious of the handful of staff officers and aides in the belfry with him. That was the reason he forced his expression to remain calm, kept his hands still as they rested on the waist-high safety railing. The light continued to improve, and his eyes tried to water with the intensity of his gaze.
"Sir," one of his aides blurted suddenly, "I thought..."
"I see it, Lieutenant," Garvey said, and he was pleased and more than a little surprised by how calmly he managed to speak. The evening before, a single battalion of Carizian infantry had been bivouacked in a restricted arc, whose broad side had been centered on the highway where it emerged from the tangled wilderness. Now, somehow, that battalion had advanced at least a full mile without any of his cavalry pickets having spotted a thing. Worse, the battalion had been substantially reinforced. His scouts had estimated the Carizian column at a maximum of 5,000 or 6,000 men. Assuming that the higher number was accurate, it looked as if at least 2/3 of the enemy's total strength had somehow managed to magically appear in front of his own men. His jaw clenched as he attempted to estimate frontages and strengths. In close formation, each infantryman covered a frontage of approximately 1 yard. In open formation, that frontage doubled. So, a 400-man battalion in close formation, with 3 companies up in a double line and the 4th in reserve, covered a front of around 150 yards. In a 3-deep line, their frontage shrank to only 100 yards. The scouting reports suggested that the Carizian battalions were larger than his own, probably about 500 men instead of 400. Assuming each of them retained 1 company as a reserve, that meant each of their battalions should cover about 200 yards in close formation, dropping to only 130 if they went to a triple line. Which seemed... The light was significantly stronger than it had been, and he raised his spyglass, then frowned. Details were still hard to make out at this distance, even with the glass. But one thing was obvious. They weren't in close formation at all. Instead, they were in a peculiar, almost staggered open formation.
"What the hell are they up to?" he fretted. "If it ever comes to a general melee, we'll go through them like shit through a wyvern, even without a single pike. So why?"
Then he realized. That formation wasn't intended for hand-to-hand combat at all. His own flintlock muskets could fire much more rapidly than the old-style matchlocks. He'd already assumed the Carizians had to be able to fire at least as rapidly as his own flintlocks, and that formation was obviously optimized to allow the greatest number of muskets to fire at any given moment. It wasn't a melee formation at all. It was one which had been specifically designed around the rate of fire of the new weapons. "Which ours haven't been," he thought grimly. "That's going to be
painful. The fact that the Carizians had managed to get so many more muskets forward and out of the constricted woodland behind them was also worrisome, although now that the surprise was beginning to ebb, that particular discovery bothered him less. The object had been to draw the enemy forward after all. The fact that the Carizians had obliged him should scarcely have been a matter for concern. Except